Hi there, I'm Tom Schultz, host of Voices of Montana, an issue-oriented newsmaker radio program. It's heard weekdays on 19 radio stations with 28 signals all across our great treasure state. Thank you for clicking on the podcast. Please subscribe, and we'll do our best to keep you connected. We're also on Facebook and on the web at voicesofmontana.com, where I'd love to hear from you. Please contact me at tom@voicesofmontana.com. Treasure State. Love that. We treasure so much about this state. And we do have a lot of resources in this state as well. Are we taking advantage of them? I think in the past we have. And maybe we have taken advantage of our resources in the wrong way. But in the right way, we have learned an awful lot about that. And we need these vital resources. I'm talking coal here today. And there was an expansion approved for the Rosebud coal mine. What's important about that? Well, number one, yeah, it is jobs. But two, we look at the energy needs in our future. AI is going to play a part in that. And I don't think those numbers add up. So it's important as we look at expanding this mine, we talk about the impact of that going forward. Rosebud Mining Company, Westmoreland, the general manager for that mine, Ken Woolley, is with us. And John Hero as well. So we'll talk. Coal and energy today on Voices of Montana. Let's welcome our guests here as we get back into energy, get into this Rosebud mine expansion, what that means, and then also, you know, kind of pick up that topic about are we going to be able to supply our future energy needs. The guest today for this segment is Ken Woolley, general manager of the Rosebud mine. Good morning, Ken. How you doing, sir?
Morning, Tom. We're doing outstanding.
Good. Thank you. Thank you for being here, and congratulations on the mine extension. I know that, especially nowadays, those things getting across the finish line are something really to talk about. John Hero is with us as well, corporate counsel, external affairs with Westmoreland Mining Company. Good morning, John. How are you doing?
Good morning, Tom. Thank you for having us.
Ken, what's the impact of this? Tell us about this mine extension, and maybe, you know, how long it took to get it across the finish line, and then we'll get into that impact. Again, congratulations on that.
No, thanks a lot, Tom. No, it's a long story. You know, I think a lot of people kind of have a mental image of, you know, the Trump administration coming in and making things happen quickly, but this is exactly the opposite. This permit story started back in 2002, started to do baseline data on it, got the first application applied for in 2011. It was approved in 2019 after pulling some critical areas out or some sensitive areas out. And we began mining in there in 2020. So we mined for 2 years, had a negative ruling that came out of the federal courts, and it, you know, things that they wanted us to fix on the permit. And you always, at least me, when I hear about a negative ruling, I think, well, they must have done something wrong, or, you know, the permit was open to having some issues that might cause some damage. The three big issues that they asked us to fix were to do an analysis on the greenhouse gas emissions from the power plant, you know, which again, we did it as part of the follow-up, but it really doesn't have anything to do with the mine. The second one was to fix, you know, to analyze the impacts of the cooling water that come out of the Yellowstone River for the power plant in regards to the pallid sturgeon. Again, there's not a pallid sturgeon within 40 miles of the mine, but again, we did that analysis. And then, you know, look at the middle case alternatives, what would it look like if we didn't mine the whole reserves and lessen some environmental impacts that way. So really, when you look at what we were charged to do in 2022 by the judge, had very little to do with the mine, but we took it on. The initial ask by the judge was to get it done in 12 months. The Office of Surface Mining, who does the permitting, said we need 19 months. Judge said, yep, no problem. You got your 19 months. And after 19 months in that plan, there was a section that had 9 days worth of work to do an alternatives analysis. After 19 months, that 9 days was not done. So, you know, I don't know what went on behind closed doors, but obviously this is a pretty competent bunch of professionals, and they weren't able to do 9 days worth of work in 19 months. So there was probably some pushback within the Biden administration that helped facilitate that. But persevered, two more extensions for similar reasons. They've got a lot of wind at their back. Senator Dane stepped up, did a phenomenal job helping tell the story and really just trying to get us a fair shake in the process. You know, the governor came to town, Governor Jim Forte, Senator Daines, and he hosted a roundtable at the mine there in Rosebud, gathered information. Then they went to work, you know, along with Senator Sheehy and, Representative Downing came to the mine, understood what we were up against. And then with Secretary Bergen, we got a lot of help and got it across the line. And really, it wasn't that anything was shortcut. Every I was dotted, every T was crossed, but we finally got the permit across the line. And, we're back to mining and back to pushing, forward on our mine plan.
Thank you for telling that story, because I think people need to understand that. Like you said, it just seems like, okay, new president, new administration, new way of doing things. But you go back to 2002. When you looked at this, and then 2011, when the application was made, that's it's a long, long process. John, I'm gonna have you, talk about that from that perspective. I know environmental reviews, streamlining those have been a part of the push to just, I think, right size our resources. It kind of goes, the pendulum swings both ways at times, and. Maybe comment on, it's hard to talk about the courts in all of this, but that's sort of where you live as well. What is your takeaway from this long process in terms of what it might set up going into the future?
Well, if I can back up just a little bit about this particular case. When we got into the Biden administration, and going forward, and when Judge Kavanaugh, put her order down, I believe in 2022, I just like to point out that from that period of time, it took OSM and the Biden administration till August 4th of 2025 to get that done. We've had multiple times where we had to request extensions from the court, and the court graciously gave it to us. However, I think the court's patience for that was starting to wane until we got into a new Trump administration. We had to ask for another extension again to at least allow this administration to take a look at, what they're signing off on. But over a 3-year period of time, when we're reaching out to Senator Daines and others, we weren't having them pick up the phone and telling them to do anything special for us. But what we were doing is having them hold the agency accountable, and especially the Assistant Secretary for Land and Minerals Management at DOI during the administration. They had multiple hearings asking not just on us, but on other NEPA reviews throughout the country and in Montana. So what I think going forward in the courts, it's hard to tell. However, there's been some case law that's come out. Oddly enough, it was from a company that was my best friend that I didn't know he was doing that. But in Colorado, called Seven Counties Infrastructure Coalition versus Eagle County, which the Supreme Court ruled on earlier this year, basically said, hey, you can't stall NEPA reviews like you have in their case in Utah. This is just a procedural case, and you shouldn't be sitting there expanding it beyond what it is. And it should go very quickly. So it's a procedural case, and I think Seven Counties is actually going to clear up quite a bit out there. Going forward, the Trump administration has issued several executive orders trying to speed that up, including an executive order in April known as the looking at or stopping state overregulation and overreach, and basically saying to the states, like, if your agencies are not going to be in line with the federal energy policy and within the law, then we're going to look at ways of stopping you from doing that and harming other states using the Dormant Commerce Clause and various other esoteric legal mechanisms that most of your listeners probably don't care about. But what it ultimately matters is that the courts cannot be weaponized as easily against us as they have been over the last 20 or 30 years.
Good. And that's good news, because that's just That's unnecessary is what that is. I think binding has come a long way. So you guys have proved that over the years. John Harrow, again, corporate counsel, Westmoreland Mining, and Ken Woolley, general manager of the Rosebud Mine, but also chief operations officer for the U.S. Mines. Ken, this so-called war on coal, and I think it's so-called aptly because of what you guys kind of just described as well, these permanent or purposeful delays and things like that. You know, I that's on the plate. That's always on our mind, so to speak. But let's talk about this extension. All right, is it some 19,000 or 1,900 acre extension? But you're expecting an additional 34 million tons of coal out of this. Why is this important for us here now?
Well, it's a couple things. It's important for the mine. When you take a look at one of the commitments that we have that we take seriously, it's to maximize the resource. It's our duty to go in and mine it and make sure that we get every bit of the coal out. And in order to do that, we blend every bit of coal that goes out so that, some coal has certain properties that needs to be diluted from other coal. And we've got two big reserves that complement each other really well. So this is one of the two reserves. And without that, it really would shrink the amount of coal at the mine, shorten the mine life. To be frank, this coal plant has the highest standard, requirement of coal quality of any plant that I've shipped to, over the 30 years I've mined coal. Out of the 150 customers I've had, this plant demands the cleanest, highest quality coal out of all of those customers that I've dealt with. So it's a tall order. So being able to get into F is important because it actually makes the whole mine more effective, longer lives. But, the most important thing is for the employees. We got 300 employees, high-paying jobs. About 20% of those employees are Northern Cheyenne members. So we end up with, a lot of the employees and supporting that are members of the tribe support multiple families. I think the average employee, the stat is somewhere around a dozen tribal members are supported by each employee that works at the Rosebud Mine. So that's a big, big deal. And if it shuts down, we've got multi-generational employees. We've got folks that are at the third generation working out at the mine. They got deep roots in the community. Of course, the tribal members have deep roots and, tradition and family, reasons that make them very hesitant to move out. And so I think it's just the ultimate hypocrisy when people say, look, we'll just train you to go do something else. Mm-hmm. It's just not that easy. That's people's lives and, people are invested in this community and our employees do a phenomenal job being part of the community and being proud of what they do and where they live. The other thing is just, the pure economics. You take a look at the taxes into the community, into the county. We provide a lot of taxes there, a lot of taxes to the state. We spend a little over $100 million a year. That turns over 6 to 7 times in the community. So support a lot of businesses in Billings, Rosebud County, different parts of it. And then this is probably something John will talk a lot more about is when you look at the energy demand growth over the next 10 years, it's phenomenal. I don't know, frankly, if the Northwest Power Pool is going to be able to grow fast enough to keep up with the growing demand. And coal is reliable. It's clean. And like I said, if it's 20 below out, that's a lot of time the wind doesn't blow. If it's 105 degrees out, a lot of time the wind doesn't blow. This coal plant's online 24/7.
And that reliability is, you'd hate to think, but nowadays our energy reliability is somewhat questionable because I think we've made an irrational rush to some renewables. And we're not, I think we can back up a little bit and be thoughtful about this. When we look at our energy demand upcoming here, especially when it relates to AI, right, and these data centers. A single hyperscale AI data center can require up to 200 to 400 megawatts. One data center, that's enough to power a mid-size city. There's a plan for, this is Microsoft and OpenAI. They have a supercomputing campus in Wisconsin plan that's expected to use as much power as the entire city of San Francisco. That future power need is not met today. And we got to start walking into that because we cannot afford to not have AI at our use. as a country and as an individual. So guest today, Ken Woolley, General Manager of the Rosebud Mine, Westmoreland Mining LLC. He's also the Chief Operations Officer for the U.S. Mines with Westmoreland. And then John Haro with us, Corporate Counsel with Westmoreland Mining. Thank you guys again for being here. John, Ken kind of set you up a little bit before there about our energy demand in 10 years. And I laid a little bit of it out as it relates to AI. That's a pretty heavy haul there, but it's not the only haul that we'll see increased energy demand in the future. Let's talk about that from your perspective, because you guys as energy providers are going to be the ones tasked with providing that.
Yeah, so we are, but I think that what you have to understand with us is that most people and even most governments and businesses are only now just waking up to the massive game-changing shift that's happening, and that has happened in just the last 4 or 5 years. And I would even say, you know, in November of 2023, ChatGPT came online to the public, and I don't think people realize how much data is required for an AI like that. They're on their fifth version now. And I would say that the view of that doesn't need to be the next 10 years, but probably in the next 25 to 50 years, and how we're going to bridge the gap from where we are now to whatever our next power source is for that. So if I could, you know, give you some of that.
Please.
You mentioned it'd be about 400 megawatts, but recently there was an 85 building, warehouse-sized building project that was proposed in Southern Virginia that would have taken about 3.5 gigawatts. And if you look at the data centers in the United States, Northern Virginia by itself, surrounding, you know, the Pentagon and the defense triangle there, is larger by double than China and the entire Asian Pacific region and their use of data centers. Mm-hmm. So what this is shaping up to be is a faster, bigger, more disruptive transformation for how the world works than I think we've ever seen before. And I really think this is a national security issue, because nations that can adapt and ride that wave will eventually lead the world. And the U.S. right now is uniquely positioned to do that versus China and others. So I'll just put it to you this way. Those countries that can't do that for whatever reason, they'll see their living standards slide. You know, I like to joke and say they risk becoming the modern day Neanderthals living in the shadows of the data centers that are drawing power from everywhere else. Mm-hmm. And so that shift towards artificial intelligence, and not just artificial intelligence, but you also have to think about quantum computing and what that means and the power demands of that means is moving at blinding speeds. So for the last, since 2005 in the U.S., power demand has been relatively flat, and that's where the renewable folks were saying, hey, we can actually meet that demand. In the last, you know, 4 to 5 years, that has radically changed. So, you know, in up until 2023, we had 24 terawatts of power usage, which is a huge number, by the way, globally. That has gone to about 30 terawatts. And by 2050, it's expected to double. Now, when I'm talking about terawatts and terawatt hours, I'm talking about 35 billion 100-watt light bulbs operating 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, every second of the day, continuously. So that's what we're dealing with over the future. And we have to figure out how we're going to meet that. I believe that an all-above approach is going to be needed to do that. But what we're going to need to do is we're going to need to bridge to SMRs and hopefully fusion power to do that in the future. I'll also say that in that period of time that we've doubled that power consumption, you know, renewables have only taken up a third of all that power supply out there. So that had to be met across the world, that had to be met by fossil fuels. We're not going away anytime soon. The best place for us to be is to how to use what we have now to bridge the gap so that we don't fall behind everybody else.
Thank you. Ken, I want to have you play off of that or respond to that. So we do need this fast transition. We have to rush, right? How do we do it rationally? Can we meet these demands upcoming, and how do we do it rationally without making mistakes like I think we have done in the past?
I think, first thing you got to do is quit indiscriminately taking power sources offline. They've been against the Colstrip power station, the 4.5 years that I've been up working at Westmoreland at the power station. We've done nothing but defend lawsuits and, really fight to keep that power plant in the game. But it's not just us. They've been against the hydro dams. They were looking to take 5 hydro dams out of Snake River over the same period. So at some point, you got to step back and say, okay, yeah, we might not like some of these, but at least have the a rational approach to not take them offline until you have an alternative. And, I think you see a lot of ideas with the modular nuclear sites, and there's a lot of testing being done on that, but it's years out, maybe decades out before some of those other ideas take effect. And, in the meantime, the rational thing to do would be to not continuously bite the hand that feeds you until you got an alternative. And that's really, I guess, our call to that is, don't leave us alone, hold us accountable to do the right thing environmentally, safety wise, everything else. But, I think it's insanity to try to shut these current sources down when you're looking at a growth curve that, frankly, even with keeping all these current sources online, it's going to be very, very difficult for the Northwest power pool to meet.
Yeah, I got a minute left. Can we do it? How, can we do it?
Yeah, I think we can. I'd never bet against the growth of the American industry. Yeah. There's a lot of incentive to do it.
Yeah, good.
Tom, I would add this. Yeah. Though. Can we do it? Yeah. Should we do it? Absolutely. You know why? Because the United States, and even though they're as difficult as they can be, the United States has some of the cleanest energy in the world, has some of the best permitting and regulatory to ensure that we protect the environment. This is where we need to do it. And we have lots of great companies that are doing that. Europe's not doing it. They're not doing it in the same way we have.
John,
we have the technological capacity.
I appreciate that too, because I'm with you guys. We can do it. The necessity is there. We just need the ingenuity behind it. Ken Woolley, John Aru, thank you guys. We'll talk to you down the road. Thanks for joining us for the podcast, and join us weekdays live from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. for more Voices of Montana on great radio stations all across our Treasure State.